Dr. Paul Thomas, thank you so much for inviting me to your office here today in Portland, Oregon.
Thanks for coming, Ty.
Yeah, really excited to talk to you today about vaccines, right?
Yeah.
It was funny, when we first checked in, Alan, Travis, and I with your secretaries up front, we said, we're here to get our teeth cleaned. Is Dr. Thomas a dentist? They said, no, he's not a dentist. So.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, this whole complex is loaded with dentists, so it was a perfect question.
Yeah. You're a pediatrician, right?
I am.
So talk a little bit about your training as a pediatrician. Where'd you go to school and all that good stuff?
So I grew up in Africa, came to the States for college, went to Dartmouth Medical School. That's where I got my degree in 1985, graduated from Dartmouth. 85 to 88, I was in residency, pediatric training, to become a pediatrician in California. University of California system, I was at the Fresno branch of the San Francisco division, and then San Diego, where I finished my training. So that was 1988. I was a board-eligible pediatrician. I went on to become board-certified and have remained board-certified. So I am a member of the Academy of Pediatrics. That may come up later in our discussion, perhaps. We're supposed to be the Academy of Pediatrics, the organization that, you know, guards the health of children. And when it comes to vaccines, which is what we're going to be talking about, I feel like the Academy has not been as thorough as perhaps I would like them to be in investigating what's going on. But anyway, back to my training. So 1988, I moved to Portland, Oregon, where we are today, and I taught residents and medical students for 5 years over at Emanuel Children's Hospital. Students would come down from OHSU, the Oregon Health Science University. And after that, in 93, I went into private practice. I was in a group practice with several pediatricians and just practicing regular pediatrics, you know, Academy of Pediatrics brand, CDC vaccine schedule, and things were going just fine, I thought. And then around the early 2000s, you know, those who might be watching who understand vaccine history here, we had, you know, Dr. Wakefield's study back in late 90s suggesting perhaps there might be something going on with the MMR. And I read that with sort of, you know, you kind of go, huh, I wonder, right? But we really didn't have any more research after that to help clarify that question. And then in 2004, the main journal that pediatricians read, it's just called Pediatrics, came out with a study. DiStefano, I think, was one of the lead authors, saying that there was no link between MMR and autism, because they had been charged, I guess the CDC had been asked by Congress to look into this. So, you know, from then on, that next year, within that next year, the Institute of Medicine, the IOM, came out with a huge report. It's been proven there's no link between vaccines and autism, no link between vaccines and thimerosal, and they made this strange statement, and we shouldn't study it any further. And I remember reading that going, that makes no sense, because we were in the midst of a crisis in our country with regards to children's health. And I'm speaking a lot about autism, but it's not just autism. I think we need to think of autism as the tip of the iceberg. In other words, we're seeing these kids who are severely damaged, but the iceberg that's under the surface is just about everybody else is being damaged in some way. So I have a huge practice, 13,000 patients. Actually, before I get into my current practice, maybe I should digress a little bit to why I started my new practice. So I mentioned I was in a group practice with four other pediatricians. And around 2004-05, I saw my first case in my own practice. So a child that I'm taking care of, who was completely normal at age one, regress into severe autism over a matter of months. So by age two, this child was nonverbal, no eye contact, you know, suffering. You know, some of these kids suffer. They have pain. They have a severe abdominal pain and GI stuff, sort of the stuff that Wakefield was charged to look at back in the day. And I'm thinking, I mean, I'm reading there's no link. You know, we don't know what's causing it, but so I'm thinking it's a coincidence. It has clearly nothing to do with vaccines.
Because and, that's what you were told.
Oh, that's what I'm reading almost daily, right? We have what we call throwaway journals for pediatricians. So there's an infectious disease journal. I mean, if you look at all the ads in it, it clearly comes from, it's supported by pharma. But it's very well written. I mean, it looks good. It's glossy, and it comes across your desk weekly. And you read, you know, pretty much almost every copy of that will have something that's elevating vaccines and putting down, you know, any possible connection, right? Putting down Wakefield as a, you know, fraud, and they would just repeat that. So you read that over and over again. I'm sort of reminded of weapons of mass destruction, and off we went to war. I mean, you hear it enough times, you start thinking it must be so. But anyway, next year, I get another case. My practice, a kid in my practice who was doing great, perfectly normal at one, becomes severely autistic. And I was seeing at that time about 100 babies a year. So maybe slightly more. 100 to 150 babies a year would join my practice at that time. So that's an autism rate of 1 in 100, 1 in 150, which is about what it's been reported to be back then. I should remind you or tell you that when I was in medical school in 1985, I saw not one case of autism. So I'm at a regional center, Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, and there I didn't see a single case. In my residency training in California, again at major centers, I had one case that I recall of what we called PDD-NOS, pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified. And that's sort of another code for autism spectrum. That's the term we used back then. One case in all those years. So it is true that the autism rate has just skyrocketed. I mean, absolutely skyrocketed. And you'll hear people say, well, we're just better at diagnosing it, right? Oh, come on. You know, these cases that I'm telling you about, so to get back to them, you can't miss them. They weren't missed. They didn't exist. You cannot miss a kid who's got no eye contact and is flapping, perhaps, and not talking when they were talking before. This was something new. This was something different. So fast forward a couple more years, I had had four cases. So in November of 2007, I walked into a room, and there was a little fellow, I know his name, I mean, he's still my patient, and he'd been normal at one when I'd seen him. He'd seen my nurse practitioner at 18 months and was doing great. And he was like we're behind the window. He had his back to the window in a stroller, and he was just doing this. And I went up to him, and I said, you know, called him by name and tried to get his attention. I can usually get kids to interact. Mm-hmm. Nothing. He was gone. And he ended up being my fourth case in 4 years of normal one-year-olds who are completely severely autistic by age two. And it was the last straw for me. It was like I'd already been doing my own research about toxins, and I knew all about the thimerosal and that how huge the dose we were giving of thimerosal of mercury was so far exceeding the safe limits that, you know, it was criminal. And I'd also been starting to become aware of the amount of aluminum that we were injecting. And I'll tell you something that most people who weren't in the trenches like I was as a pediatrician might not realize is that in 2001, at least here in Oregon, we had this huge push, and I think it happened nationwide for pediatricians, to move the hepatitis B vaccine from teenagers to newborns. And I remember when they made that push, I'm going, this makes no sense. So you catch hepatitis B from sex and IV drug use. Babies don't do that. Well, you could catch it from the mother. That's true. That's the only way a baby can get hepatitis B is if their mother has hepatitis B. And the babies in my practice, to this day, I haven't had a single mom with hepatitis B. That's how rare it is. You go to the CDC website and they say it's, 1 in 100 moms have hepatitis B. But even that, I think it's less than that, depending where you work, I suppose. But even that, we're injecting a huge toxic dose of aluminum to a newborn on day one of life for a vaccine they don't need. And you might ask, well, how did they talk you into doing that, right? Because I remember walking down the halls of the hospital talking to a couple of fellow pediatricians going, can you believe this? We're supposed to give the hepatitis B to newborns? And they said, well, you know, they're saying we might develop a population immune to hepatitis B and we can eradicate it. Sounded good.
The herd immunity concept.
Yeah. And I couldn't argue with it. It hadn't been tried. So I'm a pro-vaccine, pediatrician, you know, vaccines is the best thing we can do to you know, protect children. And so we did it, you know, in 2002 in our office, we made this huge shift, and we started, not only were we giving all the newborns their first Hep B in the hospital, at 2 months, you get your second dose, and at 6 months, your third dose, on top of the already fairly busy schedule. And we were catching up the other kids. So my own kids were in that sort of, a couple of them were in that catch-up phase. You know, they were past the infant stage, but they weren't teenagers. So a lot of hepatitis B vaccine being done at that point. And that was the same time we took thimerosal out of the vaccines. And I think about that. Because, you know, when people talk about the autism rates that have continued to go up, some of the studies have said, well, there was no change in the autism rate when we stopped thimerosal, so therefore it wasn't the thimerosal. Yeah, but we added the hepatitis B, a huge, huge increased dose of that neurotoxin right at the same time.
Aluminum. Okay.
So, you know, that might be part of the reason why we never saw a significant dip in the autism rate when we got thimerosal out of the vaccines.
Now, when you say they took thimerosal out of the vaccines, all of the vaccines?
It's not out of all of them.
Okay.
And this is the ongoing crime when it comes to thimerosal. It makes absolutely no sense to me why they chose to leave it in the multi-dose flu shot. So that's the major source of thimerosal today. The multi-dose flu shot still has 25 micrograms of thimerosal. That's a huge dose, especially if given to an infant I'm horrified that we're doing vaccines to pregnant women. No testing. There is absolutely no testing. You just read the package insert from the vaccine manufacturer. It says never tested in pregnancy. All right? And yet our CDC has recommended over the past few years, they've added the flu shot for pregnancy. And in fact, some moms are getting two flu shots because their pregnancy spans two seasons. And then, just the last couple years, they've really made a huge push to add the Tdap, the tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis. That's another whole story, but the problem with that one is huge dose of aluminum, injecting it, so you're kind of like mainlining a toxin to a developing brain, no testing. You can go to the CDC website and go to vaccines in pregnancy, and you can look at the articles that they list as justification for doing those, and I've looked at them. I've pulled every single article and read it word for word. There are no long-term studies. They're all very short-term, very small numbers, sometimes 100 or less pregnancies. And what they're calling safe has nothing to do with looking at neurotoxicity. Mm. So they're looking at, you know, birth weight, you know, things that, right, that are insignificant.
So my question, and this is, I'm really baffled. I don't understand how the CDC can say that a vaccine is safe if it hasn't been tested long term. I mean, I just don't understand the logic or the reasoning behind that.
I share your concern. So as a pediatrician, you're trained to believe that the CDC is the top. NIH and CDC are the top institutions where all the smartest people are, right? And so we just accepted what they fed us without questioning. Right, so that's where I was when I got out of medical school, and that's where I was for the first few years of my practice. That all changed in 2001 when they pushed the Hep B onto newborns because it made no sense. It is scientifically illogical and absolutely insane to inject that much toxin into a baby who doesn't even get any protection from the vaccine. We now have almost 20-year data. Actually, there are some 20-year data studies showing that the hepatitis B isn't even giving lasting immunity. So about 24% of 20-year-olds who got the vaccine as an infant still have immunity. So when they need it most, when they're sexually active as a, you know, late teens, 20s, they don't have the protection. Mm-hmm. So that was when my blind faith in the CDC just went out the window, and I started going, there's something going on here. And sadly, those who really understand what's going on, this revolving door between CDC and pharma that has been documented, I mean, people who worked at very high levels in the CDC end up working for pharma, they're conflicted. So I think, sadly, when you have conflicts of interest, You know, people like to say, well, there are no conflicts of interest here, but there are, and they've been documented.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've had several people talking about Gerberding going from CDC.
Right. Yep. So there was Gerberding. There's Paul Offit, who made the rotavirus vaccine.
Yeah.
And he sat on the very committee, the ACIP committee, that makes vaccine recommendations right before his vaccine ended up being recommended, or the rotavirus was recommended. He was working on a vaccine. He knew that. He got himself off the committee before the actual vote was made, I believe is how it went. But, I mean, he was so involved. Such a conflict of interest. So I think if viewers are not aware of this, people need to see the CDC, at least as it is today, as just a marketing branch of pharma. So their job, and you can even look at their mission statement, it's to promote vaccines, right? And if we could just change their mission to promoting healthy children, right? Let's get healthy people, a healthy society, healthy children. And look at vaccines, are they helping or not? And that's what hasn't been done. Right. We still don't have big, long-term studies that compare unvaccinated or perhaps comparing partially vaccinated. So, you know, I wrote this book, The Vaccine-Friendly Plan.
Right. Because just so people know, you're not anti-vaccine.
Absolutely not. So the dilemma I was in 2008, after I had those four cases of children who regressed into severe autism, and I'd already learned about toxicity. I'd read studies on thimerosal, on aluminum toxicity. I mean, there's books on this topic. I could no longer ethically keep doing vaccines business as usual with the CDC schedule. And the things that concerned me the most were that hepatitis B dose for newborns. Back then, they weren't pushing vaccines on pregnant women. That's happened since. And the sheer number of vaccines that were being given, for example, at the two-month visit, we were giving six different vaccines, three of which had too much aluminum. So you're multiplying huge toxins, adding on top. And it was just clearly not a scientifically justifiable approach when you understand toxicity. So I started my new clinic, Integrative Pediatrics, in 2008. And my goal was to really do something called informed consent. And this is something that is being destroyed in our country today.
What is informed consent?
So informed consent is this. Let's say you have a surgical procedure that you want to get done. You've got a mole that it might be cancerous. And the surgeon should tell you that, you know, by removing this mole, there is a slight risk of death from anesthesia. It's very minimal, and you could have a scar, but if we don't remove that mole, it could become cancerous. So the surgeon will give you the pros. You know, here's the advantage: you're not going to end up with cancer. The disadvantage: you could die under anesthesia, and we could leave you with a scar. And what are your alternatives? Well, one alternative is do nothing and take your chances, and one alternative is do this surgery that they're recommending. And there might be others, right? So informed consent is you're told the risks, the benefits, and the alternatives. All right, so it's kind of first do no harm, which doctors are supposedly, they say we take that oath. I don't know if schools really do that anymore, but we are taught that. You know, there's a term that I remember vividly being taught in medical school, and that's iatrogenic. So iatrogenic is caused by what we do. All right. If you take
what a doctor does.
Exactly.
Okay.
So if you take a medicine that I prescribe and it makes you ill or causes you harm, that's iatrogenic. All right. And I think we've lost our way in looking at vaccines and looking at what are the iatrogenic effects. In other words, what harm is being done by our vaccine program? And in an attempt to have a safer vaccine approach, I did something in 2008 when I started Integrative Pediatrics that is pretty much unheard of for a pediatrician to do, and that is to one by one give parents the real facts about the vaccine, the benefits of the vaccine, the risks, and the alternatives, so informed consent. And I truly believe this is what doctors should do. We need to get back to doing that if we're doing something to a healthy person. You know, you got a healthy child in front of you, and you're saying, well, we're going to do this thing to you, this vaccine, and it's a good idea. And all they're being told is it's safe and effective. Do it. And oh, by the way, if you don't do it, you're going to have to leave my practice. That's what's happening today. That should be illegal. I mean, if you have a doctor that's telling you to leave your practice if you don't do what I say, that's called paternalism, and we were taught in medical school that is the worst way to practice medicine. And yet the Academy of Pediatrics is now saying that's okay. So anyway, I'll go back to 2008. I'm starting my new practice, and what I set up was what I've outlined in this book, The Vaccine-Friendly Plan, and that is a way to vaccinate that's a little gentler, way less toxic. So you don't do hepatitis B for newborns who don't need it, right? And we know. Our OBGYN colleagues have done a great job of testing women who are about to have a baby, and we know when they're delivering that they don't have hepatitis B. So that baby does not need that vaccine. Let's do that one when they're preteen, you know, before they're sexually active or early teens. So that one you wait. You also wait on polio, not because I'm against the polio vaccine. The elder generation, I have a nurse who's retired who lived through the polio era, and my own mom, in fact, and they were both like, and she's a nurse, they're both like, oh, I don't know about the polio. You better do the polio. But here's the fact. There hasn't been a case of polio acquired in the United States since 1979. There is no risk. If we want to do it, we can still do it later when the immune system is more developed, when you're not bombarding that little baby's developing immune system with so many challenges. So we wait on the polio. We don't do the rotavirus. So the rotavirus vaccine, that's
the one you were mentioning that Offit developed?
Offit developed the initial one. Okay. So the first one that came on the market was clearly causing intussusception, intestinal obstruction, and got pulled. All right, and there's world data that vaccine is still doing that. All right, so it's a vaccine that has some real risks, and for me, the benefits are negligible, if any. So I've been practicing pediatrics for 30 years, and I have had maybe two or three kids end up in the hospital for IV fluids from severe vomiting and diarrhea that was caused by rotavirus. That's the worst case scenario. If you live in a country or if you live in a city or if you live in a place where you can get to a hospital and get IV fluids, that's probably 1 in 10,000. I'm just throwing out a guess number just based on my experience. But it's a very rare likelihood that you're going to need IV fluids. And I've actually looked at my own data because since I don't do rotavirus, I thought I should look at the data and see, are my kids sicker? Are they having more vomiting or diarrhea? Are they ending up in the hospital more often? And you might be surprised to find out the rotavirus patients, so they would join my practice, they'd already gotten that vaccine, had more diarrhea, more vomiting, more ER visits, way more office visits. For what? Vomiting, diarrhea, gastroenteritis. So the data doesn't support using that vaccine at all, period. There's one other fact that people may not know about that vaccine. If you don't start that vaccine by 9 months of age, you can't give it at all. You have to give it to little tiny babies.
The rotavirus.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you're a one-year-old or two-year-old or you or I, we can't take that vaccine. You might say, well, why? Well, it makes us sick. It clearly makes us worse. It's dangerous for us. But somehow, it's okay to give it to a two-month-old with a very immature immune system. You're putting a live virus that's contaminated. These vaccines are not pure. They're contaminated with other viruses. Both the vaccines that are on the market have been proven to be contaminated. It makes no sense. So we're skipping Hep B, polio, rotavirus. And in the vaccine-friendly plan, what we are focusing on is the Tdap, mostly because of the pertussis. Now, this is a tough one because let me give you the informed consent talk about the pertussis. So whether or not you got it while you were pregnant, which if it was my wife, I wouldn't. I just don't. There are no safety studies of injecting aluminum into pregnant moms. So, but whether or not you got it during pregnancy, we have a handful of deaths a year in the United States from pertussis, whooping cough. And any death, if it's your baby, that's bad, right? So the way pediatricians think and infectious disease experts, and a lot of times it's the infectious disease experts who end up at the CDC and make all these recommendations. And I mean, they are the most well-read on infectious disease, right? And they also see the worst case scenario. So if you talk to any pediatrician or infectious disease person, we've probably treated or known about a child who was on a respirator fighting for their lives for whooping cough. And so that's why you'll hear pediatricians are just, you know, adamant, you've got to do this vaccine. And it might, probably would, reduce your risk to getting whooping cough. The current Tdap that we have, the acellular pertussis vaccine, is not very effective. In fact, it's so ineffective that they're now, the CDC now recommends for pregnancy, you get it every pregnancy. So if you just had a baby and you've just delivered and you get pregnant again, it's only been a year, they're going to want you to do it again. Why? Well, it's not giving very good protection. So if we give you another one, maybe it'll give you some protection for that baby. So how many deaths are there a year in the United States from whooping cough?
You want me to take a guess?
Do you know?
Less than 10.
You're right. It's usually 5 to 10.
Okay.
So most people would probably think millions because of all the fear, right? There's right. 5 to 10 deaths. Most of them are in infants. In fact, most of them are 3 months and under. So if you're going to get any protection, maybe you should give it during pregnancy. That's their rationale, right? Because those few deaths are happening in the first few months of life. That's the rationale, but they're not looking at the toxin side. So if you're giving informed consent, people need to know, do I want to poison my baby? Guaranteed poisoning for the possible chance I'm going to... How many births do we have in the U.S. per year?
4 million.
Perfect.
Like
4 million.
That.
So we have about 4 million births, and let's just say we have 4 or 5 deaths per year. So it's a 1 in a million risk of you losing your baby to pertussis.
Literally 1 in a million.
It's literally 1 in a million. If it's my baby, I'm willing to take that risk. If, in other words, not do that vaccine and take that 1 in a million chance. Much more likely to be struck by lightning probably twice or in the same spot. I don't know. That's not to underestimate the tragedy for that person who loses their baby. But if you're doing scientific research, you need to look at data, right? So you've got a guaranteed risk of toxicity because you're injecting aluminum to a very small body. There is a... How much aluminum is safe? This is something I want us to talk about. There's an FDA document that's live today. It's been up since 2000 that says not to exceed 5 micrograms per kilogram per day, or you can cause neurological problems and bone deposition and probably other problems. Okay, so the New England Journal of Medicine article, and I think it was 1998 by Bishop, they found that for every day you were on more than 5 micrograms per kilogram per day of Hyperal, which had that aluminum in it, you lost 1 point on your Bayley's developmental score. So this is significant developmental damage from aluminum. Now the interesting thing that gets debated and it drives me nuts is that was a study of Hyperal, so aluminum that was in the food that goes in the vein, and they talk about parenteral aluminum. That's what the FDA put in their document. That's what Bishop was talking about. Parenteral means outside of the enteric system. So in other words, it's injected. It's either directly in the vein, which is what they were referring to there. But when you give a shot, that's parenteral. You are not giving it through the oral cavity. And the CDC has, you know, articles and statements about the safety of aluminum, and they're using enteral doses.
Something you would ingest.
Yeah. Our GI tract is like our skin. It has an epithelial lining whose job is to protect us from toxins. And there's a whole system set up in the GI tract to help you not have toxicity from what you eat. Because, you know, when you eat food and dirt and whatever, there's toxins. Well, we have a mechanism for avoiding toxicity when you take it orally. There, you bypass those when you inject. And so this is why it is vital that we start looking at the aluminum content of vaccines the same way we did for mercury, thimerosal, because we are far exceeding the safe doses. Just use the newborn hepatitis B dose as an example. It has 250 micrograms of aluminum. And remember, we're not supposed to exceed 5 micrograms per kilogram. Well, what does a baby weigh? At the most, 5 kilos. I mean, that's an 11-pound baby, practically. So 5 times 5. A 5-kilo baby, don't exceed 5 micrograms per kilogram. 25 micrograms of aluminum is what is supposedly the safe limit. With any toxin we've learned, like we did with lead, there's no safe dose, right? But even if you go with that dose, we know if you exceed that, it's not safe. And we're injecting 250 micrograms. 10 times the possibly safe dose, known toxin injected into every baby born in America. And what parents don't realize is when you go into a hospital and you sign and give permission for them to do all the routine care, you just gave permission for that vaccine. It will happen shortly after you deliver that baby. There won't be another discussion about it because you're not going to see the pediatrician until hours after birth. So you're going to finish delivering your baby. You'll get a little bit of skin time, and the nurse says, well, we're going to dry the baby off, and they take the baby away, and bam, bam, ointment. It happens like that. Like clockwork in every hospital in America, it is a standing order, at least it is in all the hospitals in Portland, Oregon, and my understanding it is that way everywhere. The system to promote vaccines, so if you make vaccines, you want them given. And if you can have it become a standing order, that is a guaranteed sale. So the push has become vaccinate, and the push has become let's get the message out there, vaccines are safe and effective, and let's squash any idea that there's a problem with vaccines. And if our media would be honest, they would look into things like this. I mean, this is what bugged me since 2001. When they moved that Hep B to newborns and nobody cared, nobody made a fuss, nobody looked into it, it was like, all right, we got a problem. And it's just, the magnitude of the problem is just growing.
Mm. Yeah. Now, you mentioned the DTaP.
Yeah,
so that's a vaccine that you give here if the parents want it.
I mean,
is that on your list of you discuss the pros and the cons, you give the informed consent and let them choose.
Right. So if we're gonna study and get some good data about what's a safer way to vaccinate, if there is such a thing, then we need to come up with some alternatives to the CDC schedule. And so, you know, when I branched into my practice here, and I'd been doing the CDC schedule at my old practice until 2008, I mean, I was starting to educate my patients about the problems, but for the most part, they were following that schedule. And the reason I had to leave that practice was over this vaccine issue. My partners felt it was unethical not to do all the vaccines. I felt it was unethical to do all the vaccines. You know, I felt like you have to give informed consent. What people don't realize is informed consent is only as informed as your doctor is who's giving the informed consent, right? So unfortunately, most of my peers don't even realize there's aluminum in these vaccines. Or if they do, they don't know how much is in there. If they do, they don't know what the safe dose is for aluminum. Because you see, we were trained that aluminum's safe. It's been in vaccines since the beginning of time, and it was studied, and it was proven to be safe. At least that's what we were told. But if you go really look into it, there's hundreds of studies. I have two books, entire books, just on aluminum toxicity. There's ample information that should have us questioning what we're doing.
You just said something that caught my attention. You said most of your colleagues don't even know what's in the vaccines.
Right. So
I don't understand how that can be.
I've got a daughter in medical school and a really good friend in medical school, and I've asked them, because they're already being taught vaccines are safe and effective, and they're the best thing you can do to further the health of the population. They're already being taught this. And I was never taught when I was in medical school 30 years ago what was in a vaccine. We were only taught that they're wonderful and do them. So no, most doctors trained today have no idea what's in the vaccines. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at package inserts for pharmaceutical products, they're usually, you know, they're folded up nice and small on very thin paper. And they're usually about this big, tiny print, both sides, and hidden somewhere in that maze of tiny print that you can't quite read would be the actual ingredients in the product, whether it's a vaccine or a medication you're taking. And somewhere in there is this long list of potential side effects, right? And as a physician, every time you wrote a prescription, if you were to stop and go through all of that, well, you might as well close your doors. There is not enough time in the day to do that level of informed consent. So it does take people like you, you know, with the training and education that you're putting out with programs like this, to start educating people about things like what's in the vaccine.
Okay.
You know, that's an important point. People need to think about that.
So let me ask you this, Doc. Once you educate your patients, well, educate their parents.
Right.
Right, because most of your patients are tiny.
Right.
You educate their parents, let's say, about the DTaP vaccine.
Right.
You let them know about the aluminum and the potential side effects.
Yep.
You still have parents that get the vaccine.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
So when I opened my practice here in 2008, and I was making this huge shift from doing them all to just doing a few, I would say most of my patients followed the vaccine-friendly plan, which is promoted in my book.
Which is no rotavirus, no polio, no Hep B,
and
DTaP if you want it, or Tdap if you want
it. Right, so at 2 months, you do the Tdap and the Hib.
What's the difference in DTaP and Tdap? Just different manufacturers?
Well, if you have the little A in there, that's acellular pertussis. So the A before the P is acellular pertussis. And since about early 90s, we changed in the U.S. from the DPT without the A.
Okay.
So that was the diphtheria tetanus pertussis. That was called the whole cell.
So now it used to be DPT, now it's Tdap.
Yeah.
And then the A before the P is acellular pertussis.
There's DTAP and Tdap. The Tdap is the 7 and above, 7-year-olds and
okay,
above.
Okay, I got it. Okay.
There's just a little age difference,
okay.
slight difference. But if it's got the little A, it's acellular, which, by the way, has not been working very well. It worked okay in the beginning, and the organism, some of these bacteria, in the case of the pertussis organism, they adapt to the pressure, you know, environmental pressure and natural selection. And so the pertussis organism has changed over these last 20 years or so. And now they're finding there's this protactin protein and there's a change in that. So the vaccine isn't effective.
And that's the one you were saying they recommend for a pregnant woman every time she's pregnant to get another. Okay.
Yeah, because it's just not working very well. But to finish describing my schedule, the vaccine-friendly plan, it's at 2 months you do the Hib, which is preventing Haemophilus type B. We'll talk a little more about that.
Okay.
And the Tdap. So you're protecting against tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis. The tetanus and the diphtheria are not an issue, really, for a kid that age. But it's the pertussis. You don't want that whooping cough and death, you know, those 5 deaths per year or whatever.
Okay.
And then rather than doing the Prevnar, which is the other serious bacterial disease can be caused by pneumococcus. So the Prevnar 13, it replaced the Prevnar 7. That will prevent some meningitis and some serious infection, as will the Hib. Instead of doing them at the same time at 2 months, we move the Prevnar to 3 months. It also contains aluminum. So at 2 months, you're injecting Hib, which is a fairly safe vaccine, Tdap, which has too much aluminum, and then at 3 months, you do the other aluminum one, the Prevnar, and you repeat that 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, 9 months, and then you do your final Prevnar and Hib at a year. That's still a lot of vaccines, but it's half of what it would have been. I've studied my data, so I pulled my data in February of 2015, and broke it into 3 groups. I got an IRB, Institutional Review Board, to look at the data retrospectively. We weren't changing anything. We were just looking at our data. So we were approved to do that. And in the first group, it was the children over 1,000 who did the vaccine-friendly plan or less. Because, you know, when you do informed consent, it's interesting. People do different things. You know, how do you get... Like, I think about how before I really was doing informed consent, how did we get everybody to do the CDC schedule? Well, we were this is the right thing to do. End of discussion. There was no informed consent. And people just did it. You're their doctor, right? People trust their doctors, so you do what they say. And in fact, today, pediatricians are being trained on how to, I would just use the word coerce, their patients into doing all the vaccines.
Well, you know, you don't lose your train of thought because I know where you're going, but I was on the AAP website and I viewed some of the videos.
Yeah.
They literally have videos showing the physicians how to coerce the patient.
Right, right. It's really, really tragic what's happened, and we were slowly, you know, how do you boil a frog or something? I don't know. If you put it in hot water, it jumps out. But if you turn up the temperature slowly, it just goes to sleep. We've been lulled to sleep, pediatricians and doctors in general. And, you know, I would deny that back in the day before I kind of became aware that was happening. Oh, no, I'm an independent thinker. I do my research. I read the most prominent journals, Pediatrics, New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA. You know, I'm reading all these journals. But are you really getting all the information you need? No, I wasn't. Mm-hmm. You have to really go searching for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about MMR? Yeah, I don't remember. You didn't mention MMR.
So, yes. So for on the vaccine-friendly plan, I made a somewhat arbitrary decision. That one worried me. It just, for two reasons. Wakefield's data was reproduced. So even though he was discredited, I've heard the man speak. He's brilliant. But as people say, he's nuclear. Don't mention his name or you're, by association, you're guilty of fraud. You know, the guy's brilliant. And he had published tons of articles that are not retracted, you know. And the findings that he found of ileal lymphoid dysplasia that he found in the gut of autistic kids who had been vaccinated with the MMR, that's been reproduced. So it's interesting. I had that piece of information, and then I had several patients tell me personally to my face, my kid was normal, got the MMR, and regressed almost immediately. So in medicine, new information usually comes in the form of what we call a case study. You know, you're going along doing the standard, and then something happens that makes you question what you're doing, and it's a case. So I had multiple cases of parents telling me this had happened. So you have to start going, well, what's going on? Could this be real? Then you find out that our Congress commissioned the CDC to do a study. And it was reported in Pediatrics there was no link. Then, in 2005, I read the article written by Brian Hooker, published in Translational Neurodegeneration, not a journal I read daily, but I scan for information about vaccines and autism, and because you have to look for it.
And you do this every day.
Yeah, every day. I wake up every morning, I look at all the world literature, what's new? That's my routine. And so I saw that article, and I thought, as I read it, it showed data. Whistleblower William Thompson from the CDC, he was actually, and I hadn't known that till I read that article, he was actually the head researcher for that Pediatrics 2004 study that DiStefano had published and that showed no link between MMR and autism. Well, when he got a hold of the data that had been intentionally excluded, inappropriately so, you don't change study design after the design just because you don't like the results. And this is what they had done. So the actual data showed a 300% increase in autism in African-American boys, and this finding of isolated autism, a huge increase in everyone. And this was like the smoking gun on when it comes to the MMR. And that all that data was sort of made public in the movie Vaxxed. I'm sure you've heard of that and probably seen it. And, you know, everybody should watch that movie. It's a documentary. I called a fellow colleague here in town. I was going to go watch the movie. I said, hey, come watch this movie with me. And he says, he's a fellow pediatrician. He says, why would I watch that? That's just nonsense propaganda. You know, so it's like, here's a documentary, but if you don't want to learn what it says, you just, you know, cast it aside as propaganda. Mm-hmm. And this is the problem we have with our media. I really feel like they pick and choose how they're going to report on things. If there's something that's along the lines of vaccines are safe and effective, you hear about it immediately. I read studies all the time that should be headlines, and nothing.
I was literally watching TV. This was a year or two ago, and you guys, Alan Travis, have seen this clip. It was a medical doctor on one of the major networks that says, they were talking about vaccines. She said, just get your damn vaccine. Right?
Right.
Like, no debate about
no
it.
No debate.
Just do it.
Just do
shut
it.
Shut up and do
just
it.
Just do it.
Right?
So anyway, I had all that information about the MMR to get back to that, and I just decided I'm going to wait till age 3. Because I had never seen a child regress into autism after age 3. Now, that was in 2008. I now have over 13,000 patients in my practice. I acquire all the patients in the area who want informed consent, who want to vaccinate differently. I acquire a lot of families who have autism in their family because, you know, they're not getting the kind of care they need. And I have since heard one story of a child, the parents did exactly what I was thinking of doing, which so wait till age 3, then do the MMR. And so far, in my own population, that's been fine. We haven't had any new autism in over 1,000 patients who followed the vaccine-friendly plan. But I did have one case where the family did that, not at my recommendation, they just came later, got the MMR after age 3 and their kid regressed. They actually had a family history of autism, so that does put them at a higher risk. If you don't have family history, what I promote, if you're going to vaccinate according to the vaccine-friendly plan, make sure you do not have a family history of autism or severe neurological problems and no autoimmune problems in the family. Those two groups seem to be at highest risk for regression into autism, and perhaps if vaccines are part of the problem, I'm not saying they are, but they sure look like they are. I mean, if you look at my data, group one, over 1,000 patients who followed the vaccine-friendly plan, no autism, no autism spectrum. When you look at 2 years and up, 4 years and up, same, no new autism. Group two, we had 238 unvaccinated kids, no new autism, no new autism spectrum. And group three was my more vaccinated kids, and we had 15 cases out of about 900, about 1 in 60.
Okay, which is about what the autism rate
is. That's about what the rate is now. Now, you know, this was a retrospective study, so obviously you can tear it to shreds, but the p-value for researchers who want to know, it's amazing. 0.00001 is like 1 in 100,000 chance that this was by accident. Mm. You know, so I think if we do the good studies, let's take large groups of unvaccinated, selectively vaccinated, and CDC vaccinated children and just follow them over time. We did this for tobacco. You know, back in the 50s, doctors were promoting this brand, right? Smoke Camel or whatever. And the doctors were telling you, it's good, it'll relax you, it'll help you. The tobacco companies back then knew. They had their own data. They knew that tobacco was a carcinogen, that there were problems. And once we did the huge studies, followed millions of people over years, decades, I mean, everybody today knows, right? I mean, everybody knows tobacco is a leading killer. We need to do those same sorts of studies for vaccines. Mm.
Just educate the viewers a little bit about what is the theory behind vaccines? Why do they work? Or what's the theory behind why they work?
Well, before I get into that, I just want to mention what we've lost in this whole vaccine discussion is that what really keeps us healthy is a strong immune system. All right. Now, having said that, is it possible to use your immune system and promote some aspect of it so you develop immunity against something that might be causing harm? And I think the theory of vaccination goes way back to smallpox, cowpox, Jenner, and you know all those pioneers. And they were able at that time to take a little bit of something that was causing disease or that was similar to it and get it under the skin and get your body to mount an immune response so that in the future, when you got exposed to smallpox, let's say, your body was ready to go, right? So in a simplistic term, I think that's what we're trying to do with vaccines. We're trying to prime the immune system with the organism that's been killed or pieces of the organism that's enough for the body to recognize it, and you develop antibodies so that next time you're exposed, your immune system reacts quickly, and you don't actually get sick, so you'll have a huge immune response. And you know, to some extent, we've been successful, but where we've lost, you know, we may have won a battle, but we've lost the war, in my opinion, is the collateral damage. So, you know, if you take the Hib, I was in training in California the year that was introduced. 1987 in Fresno, California was when we introduced it. And it came down from the CDC, do it, and we just did it. The CDC knows best, and that's how it always has been for pediatricians. The CDC says do, we jump. And we just take it at face value, it's the right thing to do. They've done the research. And in that particular case, I'm a brand new, you know, medical school graduate, and I'm being told this is a great idea. And actually, at that time, we were seeing a lot of meningitis from Haemophilus type B. I mean, a lot. As a resident, I was doing lumbar punctures where you put a needle in the spine and you draw out the fluid, send it off to the lab, 3 to 6 a night. You know, these would really sick kids in the emergency room. You'd get called from your, you know, you're on call. You're basically not sleeping, but you'd try. And you'd stumble down and do a lumbar puncture and start them on antibiotics. And you know, hospitals had a lot of kids with meningitis back then. We used to see epiglottitis, that little thing in the back of your throat would get really swollen. You'd have to intubate them to make sure they were okay so they didn't obstruct their airway. We saw cases of that. Those things are gone today. I mean, you almost never see bacterial meningitis. You certainly didn't see type B, all right? And that vaccine didn't have aluminum, didn't have mercury, so it felt like it was a pretty safe vaccine. It did have formaldehyde, which is not a great thing to be injecting. But I palpably saw a huge drop in meningitis that following year after we instituted that. And some of the data showed that to be the case. So, man, I'm a believer, right? I mean, this is amazing. So it just reinforced my belief in vaccines. What we need to know, though, today, if you're going to give informed consent, so I've got, you're my parent, and we've got your two-month-old baby, and we're going to talk about the Hib. What you need to know, and this data is on the CDC website, that Haemophilus influenza type B, that's Hib, causes only a handful of cases of disease, serious disease, a year in the United States. So again, it's one of those one in a million cases. Now, there might be 200 to 400 cases of Haemophilus meningitis non-typeable or other, right, but not type B. Why is that? It possibly is that that vaccine was so effective that we don't see that strain anymore, right? And that happened with the Prevnar. We used to have a Prevnar 7, that's pneumococcal, the other major cause of meningitis and serious bacterial disease, and we started seeing other strains. So they came out with the Prevnar 13. Will there be a Prevnar 21? I don't know. You know, we keep chasing these things as they shift. I digressed, I believe.
Well, you were talking about Hib, that we don't see just a handful of cases yep. of type B.
Right. So for informed consent for the Hib, some families who are really averse to vaccines, they're just afraid that it's overstimulating their child's immune system and they want natural immunity, they might be comfortable with that risk of one in a million from type B.
You mentioned SIDS. So what do you think of SIDS? So is it possible that some SIDS deaths are actually vaccine injury that's misclassified?
So I think it's absolutely possible. As a pediatrician, I was trained that, you know, vaccines are safe and effective, and of course they have nothing to do with SIDS. SIDS is sudden infant death syndrome. Whenever you hear syndrome at the end of something, it means we don't know, okay. Right? These kids just died. And I just saw an article this morning. I was looking over some things, and I think it was from 2007, but there was somewhere overseas, there were twins who died within hours of getting their vaccine, like within the next day, both of them. And it's like, boy, when you read that, and it was presented as a case report of, you know, you can have, I forget how they named the study, but twins who die of SIDS, right? So this unknown death of unknown cause. They incidentally both got vaccinated the day before. To me, that's not a coincidence. Once again, we don't do good risk follow-up, right? We give our vaccines and then off you go. And then in the United States, we have the VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. And this is the system that doctors or patients, anybody can report a possible vaccine reaction to. The reason it doesn't work is this, Ty. I'm a pediatrician. I should be seeing all these vaccine reactions, right? And you ask any pediatrician, how many vaccine reactions have you seen? I haven't seen any. I mean, a little bit of redness where the shot's given and some fever. We expect that. But no, I haven't seen any reactions. How can that be? Well, either there are no reactions or we don't know what to look for. I think it's the latter. So here's the thing. Kids will have seizures after vaccines, and we'll say, oh, well, that's normal. Because you can have febrile seizures, and that's a normal thing. We're taught that febrile seizures are normal. And are they? I don't know. Let's look at the unvaccinated and the vaccinated. Let's follow them and see, do the unvaccinated have febrile seizures as well? SIDS. I'm trained to think that that's just normal. We don't know what causes it, but it's normal. Well, let's look at the unvaccinated and the vaccinated and see if they both have the same amount of SIDS. Neurological problems, autism. which remembers the tip of the iceberg. What about all the ADD, the ADHD, the autism spectrum, the anxiety and the depression that we're seeing? And we're not even talking about all the autoimmune stuff we're starting to see at higher levels, diabetes type 1, and we're seeing way more allergies and eczema, and you're hearing more and more about people with peanut allergies that have to carry EpiPens around. Would that still be in that unvaccinated arm? Would they have all those same, you know, levels of these disorders, these chronic diseases that we're seeing in kids? I'd love to see this study be done. That's what we need to do. I mean, let's quit pointing fingers at each other, you know, because basically we're all operating in an area without information, right? And if we're gonna answer these questions and save the children of America and of the world, we need to do the right studies. And they just keep studying one vaccine at a time, and they look for a few months or for a year, and then they're done. Well, no, follow these kids and compare them to unvaccinated. It's got to happen. We've got to do it.
What you just said really struck a chord with me. It's really, I think that the thing that all of us have in common, regardless of what your perspective is, and I think that it's a caricature to say you're either anti-vax or pro-vax, right? There's, most people are in the middle somewhere.
Yep.
They're just not sure.
Yeah.
But the thing that we have in common is everybody just wants healthy kids.
Right.
Right? We want our kids to be healthy.
Yep.
And if we want the kids to be healthy, these vaccinations should be studied to find out if the risks outweigh the benefits.
Right.
That's just the bottom line.
That's what we need to do. It appears the CDC is incapable of doing those kinds of studies. So we just need to move that research and move those dollars out of the CDC and into a new branch that is charged with really doing this kind of research. Because they're conflicted. Mm. And I don't know if you can change that culture. We need to just accept them for who they are. They're great at collecting data, but only if it serves the purposes of pharma, it appears. So we just need to change it and really do the right studies long term and get going on those. I mean, there's a glaring example of sort of tobacco science, I'll call it, when we look at the HPV vaccine. So that's my least favorite vaccine, and I'll tell you why. When it first came out, the HPV 4, you know, how do doctors learn about new things? So I've been in practice 30 years, so obviously this was brand new, and I might go to a conference on something and learn something new, or I might have what they call them drug reps, and I actually let them into my practice because I just want to know what's going on out there. There are practices that say, oh, we're not going to talk to drug reps, and, you know, I honor that as well. I see the value of just trying to keep it pure, but I want all the information I can get, and then I'll go and do my own research and try to figure out what's really going on. So a drug rep comes into my office with the new HPV information, and they're touting this great vaccine. In fact, I'm invited to a dinner that's put on by a professor at the University OHSU, one of the infectious disease professors, and I don't drink, but my colleagues are drinking wine, and we're getting served wonderful food, and we're hearing this wonderful talk about HPV and how wonderful it is. It's going to prevent cancer, and look at these studies. It's showing decreased cancer. And we walked out of there thinking, this is a really great vaccine. In fact, I ordered some from my office, so that's why you shouldn't have drug reps in your office. I just answered my own question. But I learned real quick. So I'm looking at the studies that were done by the company, right, that makes this vaccine. And there was something that bothered me. So in vaccine studies, if you're really going to compare the side effects for the vaccine compared to not, you need to do placebo. And placebo, if you're injecting a vaccine, should be injecting saline. That's the placebo. Well, they injected the same huge dose of aluminum as was in the vaccine. I'm already aware that aluminum's a huge toxin. So, I mean, there's studies associating aluminum with Gulf War syndrome, with all sorts of neurological problems. So that's not a valid study. But it was accepted. They actually stopped their research early because they saw a slight decrease in cervical dysplasia. So it has never prevented a single case of cancer. But they got what they wanted. They found some decreased cervical dysplasia in their study group, and they stopped the study, and this is our wonderful vaccine. We're going to prevent cancer. Mm-hmm. And it went to the market. Down the road, they come up with the HPV 9, the new Gardasil, okay? And guess what they use for that placebo? HPV 4. Mm. So instead of injecting that one with saline, they use their own vaccine that never had a proper placebo as the placebo, and they just compare those two, and they look at these side effects. They're the same, so it's safe. Well, if you look at the actual deaths, just look at deaths. There will be more deaths from that vaccine than there will ever be cervical cancer. You just look at the number of studied and the number of deaths, and it's horrendous. So that vaccine is no longer being done in Japan. They had a huge patients coming forward with severe autoimmune problems, deaths. And, you know, in Japan, they're allowed to talk about side effects. So Japan always tends to be ahead of the U.S. in figuring out when there's a bad vaccine. That was actually why we got rid of the wholesale DPT, because Japan figured that out and went to the acellular 7 years before the U.S. Well, in Japan, 2 years ago, there was, I think, 79% were still doing the HPV. I think last year it was 2%. You know, once the real information comes out, people can make informed decisions. We don't get informed information here in the U.S. We need those studies.
That's great information on the Gardasil. It boggles my mind that they could actually put out what they say is a randomized controlled test,
right,
that doesn't have a true placebo.
Yeah, it's happening all the time. But that particular vaccine was the most blatant. And yet it got fast-tracked, right? Approved by the FDA, fast-tracked. And now it's being pushed big time in the U.S.
Yeah.
I mean, I see commercials on TV. I wished I had known. I wished my parents had told me, right? It's just pulling at the heartstrings. It's just marketing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they've got a faulty product, and they want to make money on it. So they, what do? They do marketing. And we're all subject. We're victims of the marketing. There was a study in JAMA in February of 2015, I believe it was. And this was a study on folate.
It was
2013,
yes.
You're right.
Started
the,
again.
The years just... Okay. So there
no,
was
I mean, I just say
thank you.
Because somebody will say, look, he didn't even know the years.
He doesn't know what he's talking
about. I mean.
Yeah, so in February of 2013, I get the JAMA, the Journal of American Medical Association. I'm a member just to keep track of what's going on. And that was on my desk, and I'm looking at this, and anytime I see the word autism in a study, I want to know what they're doing because we need more studies. So here's a huge study out of Norway. I think it was 60,000 moms and the children followed for an average of 6 years. And they looked at the rate of autism in the moms who took folate while they were pregnant and the moms who didn't. It was a huge study, prospective, long-term, comparing these two groups. And
what is folate?
So folate is a B vitamin, B3. And we've known that you need folate to prevent huge brain defects, anencephaly, meningomyelocele, those sorts of things. So it's obviously important for something to do with brain. And we've been giving folate for well over a decade, maybe two, for pregnancy. But this was a great study to show the value. And the moms who took folate while they were pregnant, their autism rate was 1 in 1,000. And the moms who didn't, it was 1 in 500. So this is 2013. And I'm thinking, I just read it's 1 in 150 here in the U.S. What's the difference? Why is it 1 in 1,000? Because we give folate in the U.S. So why is it 1 in 1,000 there and it's 1 in 150 here? That was the aha. Right, but there was no mention of that in the article. So I pulled up the vaccine schedule for Norway, and they don't do the hepatitis B vaccine. I'm not saying that's the whole reason, because they do breastfeed longer and much higher breastfeeding rates there. We know breastfeeding is protective. They have less toxins. There's no GMOs, or at least I don't think there are. So I'm sure there's lots of variables, but the exciting thing about that is, just think about it, Ty. If we could do a few things here in the U.S. and get our rate from now 1 in 50 back to 1 in 1,000, how wonderful would that be? Mm. I mean, you're talking, we now have over 1 million autistic kids. We're creating over 100,000 a year with our current program of whatever it is that we're doing that's creating this. I do believe, this is a talk about vaccines, that's a big piece of the puzzle, but that's not the only piece. It's toxins, 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 and it's getting your nutrients, like folate in that study. It's actually good to have methylfolate, not regular folate for most people. And it's boosting the immune system. It's all about having a healthy immune system. That's what we need. And we need to be eating real food. I know in your book on cancer, you make a big push about that. I mean, you're not going to have a healthy immune system if you're eating the sad American diet, right?
And you mentioned the immune system. So is vaccination the same thing as immunization? Are those terms, do they mean the same thing?
Well, we use them interchangeably. We say immunization, vaccination. But immunity is a whole different ballgame, right? So immunity is how robust is your immune system to fight anything, right? So there was a study out of Canada, I think it was last year, where they looked at people who had gotten the flu shot every year compared to people who hadn't gotten the flu shot, and how did they respond to a new flu virus, right? Because they're always trying to predict what's going to be the next flu virus. Those who had not been getting those yearly vaccines were much less likely to be infected by a new strain. So there's something about over-vaccinating that actually harms your ability to fight other infections. And that's another piece of data that we really need. So in my own study, what I found was that unvaccinated group of 238 patients by far were the least ill. So I also tracked how many office visits they came in for illnesses. I mean, it was like a fraction of the visits. These are healthy kids, and they're not vaccinated. So they have a robust immune system through your natural state and probably better nutrition, maybe better longer breastfeeding. I didn't have enough data to look at those factors. But immunity is different from vaccination. You know, vaccination, you're targeting that organism. And yes, you might boost the immunity against that organism, but what are you doing to the whole picture?
Got it.
And we're not looking at the whole picture. We need to.
Talk about chickenpox. Chickenpox vaccine, what's it, the Zostavax or?
Varicella. Varicella, the Varivax, they now have one for adults for zoster.
Okay.
Yeah, for the older folks. But for children, it's varicella vaccine, Varivax. It's recommended age 1 by the CDC. So I had chickenpox. I'm guessing you did too.
Yep.
As a kid. My kids all had chickenpox. It used to be one of those rites of passage, right? It's not fun. It's itchy. You miss school for a week. Most kids love that. Deaths from chickenpox obviously is always the big scare, right? And historically and traditionally, there were about 100 deaths a year in the U.S. Almost always, it would be somebody who was immunocompromised. So they were already at risk for death from some infection. But any death is not a good thing, right? So we would like to prevent those deaths. So in comes the varicella vaccine, the chickenpox vaccine. And in my practice, ever since it was introduced, I've always had a number of families that didn't want to do it. They just felt like they wanted their kids to have natural immunity. The vaccine actually works fairly well. So I just had a case of chickenpox yesterday in my practice. It's rare. I mean, I think I could count on one hand the cases I see in a year. We used to see it every week, almost every day. We'd meet them in the parking lot so they didn't come into the office and contaminate everybody. It's very airborne, it's very contagious, and it's just not around anymore. But guess what is around now? Zoster, herpes zoster, which is actually a reactivation of chickenpox. And you can get zoster whether you're vaccinated or whether you had natural chickenpox. And what we're now seeing is the elderly, but we're even seeing zoster in kids. That never happened before. But we're seeing the elderly are having debilitating zoster and sometimes death from chickenpox reactivation. And that is now a new epidemic. And I've read, I don't remember the exact numbers, but we are losing more adults to chickenpox than we ever lost anybody to chickenpox prior to vaccines. So what's happened? I'm pretty sure what's happened is because the chickenpox vaccine works fairly well, kids aren't getting chickenpox anymore. Those kids who got chickenpox were actually the people who kept our immunity boosted through the years. So my kids had chickenpox, they boosted my immunity. Well, now that kids aren't having chickenpox anymore, nobody's getting boosted. And so now that you're having this rise in zoster cases and
now, is that shingles?
Shingles, yeah.
Okay.
So we've made a trade from kids who got chickenpox and could handle it to now the elderly and older people getting reactivated chickenpox, zoster, and shingles. And sometimes it's more debilitating, if not deadly at times. I don't think it's necessarily a good trade-off. I think we might actually be wise to just go back to letting kids get chickenpox. But it's so controversial.
It is.
Yeah, it's so controversial. You know, you'll hear the argument, well, your child having chickenpox is putting my chemotherapy kid, my cancer kid, at risk because they have to take their chemotherapy, which blasts their immune system and they don't have any protection. But the truth of the matter is, because I have patients who are getting chemo, they don't go anywhere when their immune system is suppressed. It's not just chickenpox. Those kids are vulnerable to everything. So their oncologist is going to tell them, you don't go to school, you don't go out into public until we get your counts up. And so in reality, that's just a theoretical thing used to scare people. But no, you're not going to send your immunocompromised chemotherapy kid to school anyway until their counts are back up.
Right. So yeah. I guess what you're saying is we're seeing the natural exposure to something like chickenpox. And we've even seen it with measles. Confers some kind of a longer-term immunity to whether it be shingles or with measles, we're seeing a cancer protective effect of being exposed to measles.
Right.
So that natural exposure gives lifelong reduction with other things.
Right. So, yeah, I read that study, I can't remember where now, about the cancer protective effect of actually having the measles or mumps infection. Yeah, there's so many unknowns, right? We do this and we think this is the right thing to do, but then we need to be able to step back and look at the outcomes of what we're doing, and does it really make sense? It's so hard to go back once you've embarked on this vaccine program. How do you dial it back? It's tough.
Discuss a little bit about some of the antibiotics that we have in vaccines and the way that actually might be affecting brain development or even have implications with autism.
So I'm not an expert on which antibiotics are in vaccines, but I could tell you that the use of antibiotics to treat infections in little children is a real concern for somehow being associated with increased autism. You know, back 20 years ago and 25, 30 years ago when my kids were younger, I was a new pediatrician, and we were just dumping antibiotics into kids. I mean, it felt like every kid had an ear infection. I mean, you'd go through the day. I remember days I would see 50, 60 patients and half of them were ear infections. And we were just writing out prescriptions for antibiotics. And my youngest son had 13 ear infections in 9 months. I mean, that's constant, right? So he just lived on antibiotics. Sorry, son. You know, we did some things that don't make a lot of sense when you really understand the full organism. So our immune system involves gut immunity as well, and antibiotics destroy a lot of your good bacteria. And there's this whole understanding now that's just finally reaching the MDs. I think the naturopaths and alternative folks have known this for some time. I've been involved in integrative medicine for over 10 years, interested for 20. So I've been aware of these things, but the microbiome and the importance of having good diversity there, we were destroying that with antibiotics. And I remember when I first heard that as a new pediatrician, oh, that's ridiculous. You know, that has nothing to do with your immune system. Well, we now know it. Of course it does. So I don't know if that answers your question, but
yeah,
antibiotics overuse, besides the fact that we're, you know, creating these superbugs, I'm less worried about the superbugs than I am about what we're doing to the microbiome. And so it is so important to have a vaginal birth through a healthy birth canal that's teeming with good bacteria that then become the beginning of that child's gut flora. You have a C-section in a sterile environment. You're in a hospital where there's hospital-acquired organisms, and that becomes your flora, and you get C. diff, and you're pooping blood and mucus, and that's not a good start. And in fact, the best way to cure those poor kids is get good probiotics and get that going. So I think you talk about it in your book, part of a healthy diet is fermented foods. You know, you need that good flora.
Well, so just two more questions. And on based on what you just said, you just talked about, you know, having a healthy vaginal birth. Talk about the way that different vaccines can cause inflammation in the womb and the effect that might have.
Excellent. So we understand that autism, for example, is an inflammatory condition in the brain. The Vargas study back in, I think it was 2005, showed universally autistic kids at autopsy had brain inflammation. They just looked at motor vehicle accident kids who happened to be autistic and had some controls who weren't, and there was a huge difference. So inflammation is part of the process. We want to avoid inflammation. There was a study that showed, I think it was the flu shot in pregnancy causes an increase in CRP, which is an inflammatory marker. So right there, that's telling me that's probably not wise to be injecting a vaccine that causes inflammation in the womb when we know there's another study that shows inflammation in the womb is associated with increased autism risk. So we don't want to trigger inflammation while you're pregnant or probably any time in our lives. And I think the whole process of, you know, healthy immunity is avoiding inflammatory conditions, avoiding toxins.
Again, Dr. Thomas, with your book, The Vaccine-Friendly Plan, you've got various families that choose different levels of vaccination. Some
right.
will, some of your 13,000 patients will do a lot of vaccines. Some will do very few, and some will do none. For those that do very few or none, what are your suggestions on how they might get natural immunity so that they feel better about not vaccinating? Right?
Okay. So natural immunity, if you get your nutrients and you avoid toxins, unless you have a genetic autoimmune or immune deficiency, and those are so rare you don't need to worry about them, that's the key. So let's start with avoiding toxins. It starts before you get pregnant. I wish I could get people before they got pregnant, which means everybody, right? Your kids. Start living a toxin-free life. So avoid pesticides, avoid herbicides, drink filtered water, not just the tap water. Avoid acetaminophen. Acetaminophen is the great multiplier of toxicity. So we all have a body burden of toxins, and acetaminophen blocks your production of glutathione. Glutathione is the major detox molecule. So just think of acetaminophen, Tylenol, as multiplying your toxicity times 10, 20, 100, I don't know. Mm. Horrible, horrible, horrible. So you need to avoid that. Flame retardants are huge. So we get our brand new baby, we buy them all new furniture, and they've got a brand new mattress, and it's off-gassing flame retardants. We put them right down on that. So that's a problem. Fluoride in the water. There's huge debate and controversy about fluoride, but it competes with iodine. Iodine is important for thyroid function, and thyroid function is hugely important for brain development. So avoid fluoride. And I mean, if you have to do it topical and spit, that's probably fine. But ingesting fluoride regularly with fluoridated water, taking fluoride supplements, even though they're promoted as the best thing you could do for your teeth, I think it's not worth the trade-off with what it's doing for your thyroid and your possible brain development. Plastics, BPA, you know, the list goes on, right? And it gets overwhelming for people. So I think you ought to start with just a few basics. Eat healthy, eat organic, or at least GMO-free, but preferably avoid it. Toxins in your food, toxins in your water, toxins in your air, in your environment. And, you know, if you want to, you can take this to a whole new level. You know, individualized medicine, it's here. If you have the extra money to spend and you can get to a physician who understands it, you can get your genetic analysis and understand all your single nucleotide polymorphisms and know that you're at greater risk for toxicity from this or that. And, oh gosh, look, so I happen to be a carrier of the MTHFR. That's just one of tons of little genetic glitches that I carry. But by knowing that I have that glitch, I need to take methylfolate and I need to avoid regular folate like the plague, right? So I understand that. But if you're going to eat fresh, whole, real food, you're 90% there, right? As opposed to something in a box or a can that came from a factory.
So again, I guess what you're saying then is it's an individualized approach is what makes sense.
Yes.
Right? Because, you know, people are different.
Absolutely. And then the idea that you would have one vaccine schedule and that's good for everybody. In a world where we now understand we can understand our genetics and our risk factors, it just doesn't make any sense. Mm. Yeah, I think individualized medicine, if we'll really use it to its best, although I was going to say individualized medicine is the way to go, but really for simplicity's sake, just eat healthy, eat real food, and stay away from toxins. And don't forget, there's a lot of toxins in the vaccines. Mm. So that is, you know, we ingest them, but when you inject them, you're mainlining. You're mainlining those toxins.
Yeah. And if you are one of the parents that still wants to vaccinate your kids, then the vaccine-friendly plan is a good place
way
to start.
Better,
right?
Right, way better. I'm hoping to have more data over the years, but there's no question the outcome data from doing it this way. So the vaccine-friendly plan is a compromise. You're saying we can vaccinate slower without putting our kids at any greater risk for diseases that vaccines protect against, right? So you're not putting your baby at risk for Hep B. They're not at risk anyway. You're not putting your risk at risk for polio. There's none in America. You're not really at any greater risk by skipping the rotavirus. And you are reducing risk by spacing out aluminum-containing vaccines. And you're reducing your risk by waiting a bit on the MMR. So measles scares people. We had that big epidemic in Disneyland. A couple hundred cases. You know, the next year there were only a couple hundred cases in the whole country. The whole decade, we've never had more than 700 cases a year. That's not an epidemic. That's just a little cyclical thing that happens. And it's no big deal. But there is no question that our vaccinating with the MMR has reduced measles in the population. So if we went to no vaccines, I think it would be okay. But would we have more measles deaths? Sure, we would. And some people can't tolerate that idea because they don't see any negative side to vaccines. But when you see both sides, that there's risks and benefits, then you can start having a real scientific dialogue about what really is best. Mm. I think that's what we need to do.
That's informed consent, right?
Yep, that's informed consent.
That's what we all should be for.
That's what we should be doing.
Dr. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ty.
Appreciate
talking to you. Yeah.